Welcome to this week's edition of the Baseball America College Podcast. I'm Teddy Cahill. Joining me, as always, is Joe Healy. And today on the podcast, we're going to dive into the top 25 transfer classes of 2021. We've talked about traditional recruiting classes with high school players and junior college players, but this week we're talking about the 25 best classes of four-year transfers with the elimination of the rule that required players to sit out a year after transferring from four-year schools. Obviously, there was a little more action in the transfer market this year. And so we, this year, I guess for the first time, have ranked a full 25 of the transfer classes. Joe took the lead on that. So we're going to get into that today, as well as talk a little conference realignment. It's relevant kind of for two different perspectives right now. The first being that there are some realignment rumors and actual realignment movement happening within the last week in the OVC and Missouri Valley. So stuff to talk about there. But also this year, there are, I guess, a dozen schools that are moving into new conferences. So it's been active. It was active before, you know, the SEC and the Big 12 got involved, and it just continues to churn. So we're going to get into the latest there as well here on this edition of the Baseball America College Podcast, which is presented by Rapsodo. Rapsodo has become the industry standard in player performance data. And evaluation. The Rapsodo National Player Database is a free service that allows you to see how you stack up against your peers and provides a pathway to get discovered by scouts. You can check out the Rapsodo National Player Database at rapsodo.com/national-database. All right, Joe, we're here. It's the end of September, and we're here to talk about some transfer classes. And you know, this is kind of the last big recruiting piece that we're gonna probably spend some time on in the podcast. At least I still am writing up newcomer classes from around the country over at baseballamerica.com. We had the Big 12 go up already this week. The Big 10 will follow suit in a couple of days here, but the transfer classes is one of the bigger pieces still. And as you know, we talked about last week with individual players, the top 100 impact players, there's been a fair amount of movement this year and just a lot more to dive into than usual. Last year, I think you did a top 10 of transfer classes. This year, you went full top 25.
Yeah, and last year was, you know, I did 10, and it was kind of like, no, they weren't even ranked. It was kind of like notable transfer classes, because last year there was so much. It wasn't just that it wasn't 100% clear on immediate eligibility for those transfers. Like we were kind of working under this assumption that basically they were going to be lenient. They being NCAA, it was going to be lenient with waivers, but you never knew for sure. So like you were kind of projecting what these transfer classes would look like next year, but you didn't know that was really necessarily going to be the case. And also, you know, there was COVID roster crunch situations and different programs. So you didn't know. There was just a lot of unknown going into last year. So it was like just threw some notable classes at the wall and didn't even rank them. And I actually haven't even gone back and looked to see who I put on that list last year. I should have. That'd be an interesting exercise to go back and look and see how many impact players were on those lists. But this year, of course, is something different. We have a really clear look at who's going where, and we know those players will be at least eligible to compete for time immediately and be productive players immediately. There are obviously some who won't, some who will, and some who are rehabbing from injuries and what have you. But we do have a very clear picture of that now. And it's a really fascinating exercise, because as you have to weigh in your recruiting class rankings, like you know this, that it's really tough when you've got this one class that's just a handful of players. And I think this is even more exacerbated in transfers, because nobody in recruiting is just taking three players. But in transfer classes, you've got two or three player classes, all three guys are probably going to be regulars in their new high profile program. And on the other hand, you've got teams that are taking 8 or 9 players and 6 or 7 of them are big question marks. And so, you know, just trying to figure out how you value those things is a really difficult exercise. So it's kind of what makes it fun though, is because there's, you know, all different types of classes. We've got small classes, we've got big classes, we've got classes full of productive veterans that are coming up from the mid-major ranks to classes full of guys who are, you know, high-end talents who have underperformed. So they really run the gamut of different types of classes. And so there's a little something for everyone in there. And while there are a lot of big name, high profile programs ranked in this top 25, teams that will compete for national titles this year, there are also some teams you may not expect to see, which I think speaks to something we talked about last week, which is that the types of teams that are really all in on the portal are pretty varied and they do it for a lot of different reasons.
Yeah, I mean, in at the top of the rankings, you've got Texas A&M and LSU, and those are two SEC programs with new coaches that, you know, went into the portal for some instant impact. A&M, you know, really looking for just to upgrade the roster quickly after finishing last place in the SEC West, and just a game ahead of Missouri for the overall in the overall SEC standings. So they, you know, they make a lot of sense in terms of that, but you know, that's like we talked about last week, a program that going forward, you may not see play quite as heavily in the portal. They might be a little more like Arkansas or Mississippi State, which is, you know, they've consistently over the past few years gone in and been very selective, but also consistently been looking at grad transfers, or now maybe a high impact player that's moving before his graduate year, like Jace Borhoffman at Arkansas this year. But you also have like Kansas State or Kentucky, you know, schools that fit a little bit different profile. So like you said, a lot of different ways that are a lot of different types of schools that are approaching this. And you know, it's also interesting which of these schools were heavily into junior college ranks before. We talked about that, like Kentucky and Oklahoma State are very into the transfer portal at this point. Previously, they recruited a lot of junior college players, and they still have some key junior college players. But, you know, does that open the door for other schools to get better junior college talent than they're used to? So a lot about recruiting kind of is changing just based on the introduction of the portal. And when I say recruiting, I mean all aspects of it, not just, you know, the transfers and the junior college transfers, but all aspects of recruiting kind of change when you introduce the idea that players can be eligible immediately from four-year schools.
Yeah, it'll be fascinating to see how the transfer portal in baseball takes shape as time goes on, and kind of look back on this maybe 5 years down the road and really take stock of not just are we seeing more or less movement, are we seeing more or less movement among high-end talent, but really which programs have continued to go all in, which programs initially went all in but decided it wasn't for them, and who has like the best hit rate. Because you definitely see this in other sports, right, where because football and basketball in particular have long been so, up until recent years, been so restrictive on transfers. It's not just sitting out a year, but it's also that it was fairly uncommon. There were some high profile, notable cases through history going all the way back to Troy Aikman, right? But there wasn't year to year just this cottage industry of transfer portal watching and things like that. It was not all that common a thing to have happen. But you've seen as time has gone on where football, like especially at the quarterback position and grad transfer thing, for lack of a better way of putting it, has really changed the complexion of that, because that's where it really started in football. But the quarterback shopping in free agency every year is like a very real thing now, to the point where I think now there's like some backlash to it, where there are some programs that are just like, we just don't do that. We're not, you know, what have you, but like with what Oklahoma has done, clearly you can see that this is effective if you get the right guys. And so in basketball, it's kind of the same way, where now there are certain programs that are just synonymous, or coaches that are just synonymous with transfer portal movement. Dana Altman at Oregon is one guy. Eric Musselman, formerly of Nevada, now of Arkansas, famously a big transfer portal guy. So there are these programs that have become synonymous with it or have known to do it effectively. And I think that same thing will happen in baseball over time. And it's just a matter of seeing where that is. To your point, I think some of what we saw in year, and so I guess I should say this first, is that I think it will also, you'll see a lot of, it really depends on your situation. A&M clearly needed a roster shakeup. And, you know, I think a lot of coaches would have come into A&M and said, hey, we're going to go low and slow on this. Let's see what we have. Let's evaluate the roster. Let's take 2022 as like kind of a year where we just kind of get a foundation set and then we'll pick up speed after that. But Jim Schlossnagel, to their credit, I think understood that, hey, no, if we're going to be, this is Texas A&M and the expectation is we're going to be at a bare minimum, not the worst team in the West. We need to make changes now. And so they took a big class and they got a little bit of everything. You know, you've got established aces and Micah Dallas, Texas Tech. You've got productive mid-major players, Dylan Rock from UTSA and Cole Kaler from Hawaii. You've got, you know, hard-throwing high-end pitchers, Trey Dillard from Missouri. You've got, you know, up-and-coming slugger and Jack Moss from Arizona State, veteran catcher, Troy Klon from Oregon State. Like they just plugged a lot of holes. You know, their lineup is going to be filled with guys coming out of the transfer portal, which I think is going to be their lineup in their pitching rotation and their you know, bullpen. It's going to be loaded with guys coming from the transfer portal. And that would be pretty new. And but I would not bet on them being that type of team year after year. I think this was a one-off, but seeing those ebbs and flows over time, I think it's going to be the most interesting piece of this.
Well, I think it's interesting what you said there, that a lot of coaches might have, you know, taken a little slower at A&M. And I wonder, like, that's the old philosophy, because you previously wouldn't have been able to do a whole lot, that you would have been hired in June. Ordinarily, the draft also would have been in June. But in third, I think when we were in Omaha, I think that's when it got announced. But like the second half of June, hired, and then, you know, the draft was about a month later. There's just not a whole lot they would have been able to do with their recruiting class. They added one pretty prominent high school player into their recruiting class, came with Nate Yeske from Arizona, had been committed to Arizona, was a pitcher, followed Nate Yeske to A&M. Sometimes you can do that. Sometimes you can add a junior college player here or there. But then, I mean, the roster would have probably pretty much been the roster. Maybe they could have found a grad transfer. But eligibility now being an option, if you're going to take over a program like an A&M or any highly prominent program in a major conference, I think this might be the way that you want to go from here on out. And there are going to be a lot of people watching A&M very closely to see how this happens. Obviously, Jim Schlossnagel is also a very experienced coach and has a very good that kind of talent. And it probably will help them understand how to manipulate the talent, the players once they get there to find the right assortment. But that's also not going to be easy. Maybe if you're a first-time head coach, that's too much for you. But, you know, I think if you are, and if it works, I think it might provide a blueprint for other coaches moving into jobs like this one. All right, so that was the top class. We're going to get deeper into the rankings here in a minute. A lot of other interesting classes following A&M in these rankings. But first, check this out.
In my house, we love Mexican food. I could eat Mexican food every day, but Tex-Mex, take your pick, burritos, enchiladas, tacos, take your pick. But my wife makes a really good homemade tortillas, but she's a teacher, she's back in school, she's back in in-person school now, and so we don't exactly have the time to make homemade tortillas. Not a problem, thanks to HelloFresh. I'm checking out right now whether we're going to get the one-pan Cantina shrimp fajitas or the Mighty Mushroom tortilla melts, because both of those look really good. And also may mix it up a little bit with Italian with the chicken sausage rigatoni. You can choose from all those things as well, because HelloFresh has a wide variety of over 50 weekly recipes that have all kind of flavors, all kind of cuisines. If you're not a Mexican food eater, not a problem with HelloFresh. You'll never be bored, because you can try something new every week. And over 90% of those ingredients are sourced directly from farmers. That's why it's called HelloFresh. It's not something that's going to sit in a warehouse for weeks and weeks and weeks. So you too can check out HelloFresh if you go to HelloFresh.com/BaseballAmerica14. That's HelloFresh.com/BaseballAmerica14. That's the number 14. And you get up to 14 free meals, including free shipping. So check it out. HelloFresh, America's number one meal kit.
All right, Joe, we talked about A&M ranking number one. You mentioned the classes that... let's look a little deeper into the top 25. What did you feel like when you were putting the top 10 together, maybe surprised you a little bit?
I guess, surprised a little bit, you know, especially after I look at the first two classes with A&M and LSU. They're both pretty hefty classes, like high-end talent, sure, but also a large number of people. Like, I was actually surprised by how many top-end classes in the top 10 were really just a few players, but all three should be immediate contributors, have high-end ability, plug holes, all kind of, or all of the above. You know, when you talk about Arkansas at three, with Jace Borofin from Oklahoma, Chris Lanzilli from Wake Forest, and Michael Turner from Kent State, all three guys that should at least project to be immediate contributors. You know, you get a little bit further down, it's a similar story with NC State. We talked about them last week with Luke James Gruver and Dominic Pauly from Charlotte, Josh Hood from Penn, Florida State, Alex Trowell from Miami, Jordan Kerrion from Florida, Brett Roberts from Tennessee Tech. So those classes are harder to place just because it's fewer players. But there were a small handful, with Tennessee also being in that mix, in the top 10 with just three players. I was kind of surprised by how many of those there were, like teams that clearly had like a very small transfer board of guys they were looking for, and then got those guys and end up with like really impact classes, because they're going to have, or they in many cases will have 100% hit rates in terms of those players becoming big time contributors right away.
Yeah. It's really challenging when you're trying to, you know, just the philosophical question of what constitutes a good class here. But I'm interested in what Florida State did. You know, Terrell coming from one of the Seminoles' biggest rivals in Miami, bringing a big proven bat, although one that hasn't always produced against the best programs. That's part of why he's still in college baseball as opposed to pro ball. And Jordan Kerrion coming from their other big rival in Gainesville, and all that he can do for them. And then Burt Roberts was pretty solid this summer in the Cape, and coming from Tennessee Tech. I mean, that's one that kind of stands out to me. Looking through the full of the top 25, it's SEC heavy. I suppose that's not particularly surprising. It's major conference heavy as well. Again, not particularly surprising. Coastal Carolina kind of bucks that a little bit at number 15, but then again, they're Coastal Carolina, and they've kind of always played in transfers, whether that's junior college or full-on transfers. So not particularly surprising. Two programs, though, that are major conference programs, but stand out to me a little bit here are Pitt. They come in at number 12, and Kansas State coming in at number 18. Both of those programs fell short of the NCAA tournament last year. Probably both feel a little bit hard done. Obviously, Pitt definitely feels hard done after getting on the short list of potential host sites and then missing the NCAA tournament completely with the poor finish to their season. I know that left a very bitter taste in everyone's mouth in Pittsburgh. And then Kansas State was a team, Joe, that you had kind of identified as a sleeper team early in the year and never quite came together for the Wildcats, but they never really went away either. They made it to the Big 12 tournament semifinals and had a decent enough RPI at the end, but it just was a little short of a tournament team ultimately. But as those programs look to take Pittsburgh and Pete Hughes at Kansas State, they bring in large classes, and just kind of well-rounded classes overall. They've got some grad transfers. They've got some younger players that can impact the program over multiple years. I mean, those are two kind of similar looking groups that I find to be pretty interesting.
Yeah, I'm with you on both, actually. Those are a couple of good ones to call out. Pitt definitely feels like a program that feels like, oh, we were really, really close in 2021. Let's not lose this momentum and make 2022 kind of a step back year before we get going again. Let's try to keep our foot on the gas here and keep moving. And I think that this class should do a really good job of that. A couple of guys, Tatum Levins and Jeff Wehler, interesting to me. Tatum Levins, a big bat from LaSalle, who's been really good for them his few years there before they cut the program. And Jeff Wehler, probably one of the more underrated guys who I had in the top 100 in terms of really productive hitter, does a lot of different things, both defensively and offensively. I'll be interested to see what he does there. But it is a well-rounded group for that, where I think that's plugging a lot of different holes. Kansas State is a little bit different. I think it's a similar philosophy, because I do also think that they felt like they were really close last year. And the numbers showed that they were a couple wins away from being right there in the at-large discussion. But they're interesting because they do lose some talent when you talk about on the pitching staff, where they got, starting with a guy like Jordan Wicks.
I mean, they lost like five players to the draft, I think.
Yeah. So, I mean, they did lose some guys. So, I think this may be an attempt to kind of preempt a step back in 2022. But I think what's interesting about the strategy, or the apparent strategy, I guess I should say the apparent strategy here, because it's not like I've talked to Pete Hughes or his staff about it explicitly, but it does seem like Kansas State has really gone all in on, or at least heavily on, highly regarded recruits who, for whatever reason, just didn't necessarily take on first attempt at their original program. So you're talking about Dom Johnson, highly regarded guy, just outside the top 300 on the BA 500 coming out of high school, goes to Oklahoma State, doesn't get much of an opportunity, but has big time tools, most notably his speed. Let's see in year two if he can get it turned around here. Same deal with his teammate, Orlando Salinas from Oklahoma State. Advanced defensive middle infielder, didn't play last year at Oklahoma State. Let's see if we can turn him into something here. Blake Adams at Arkansas, hard throwing pitcher, didn't get a lot of innings at Arkansas, kind of wants to be a two-way player. Like, okay, let's give him a shot at that. But most notably, let's see if we can make him a weekend starter. Christian Rubeck at Oklahoma, hard throwing guy. Stats really aren't there. So like, there are some exceptions to this. Josh Nikoloff from Columbia, productive player over several years there. Jeff Heinrich at South Carolina, a little more proven there, at least in terms of the amount of playing time. So there are exceptions to this rule, but it is largely a transfer class made up of guys who are like post-hype recruits, if you will. Guys that still have maybe some ceiling they haven't met, in case they just making a bet that they're able to get the high reward in this high-risk, high-reward play.
And I would venture a guess, as a lot of these are coming from Big 12 schools, or Arkansas is very close to Big 12 country. They're probably all players that Kansas State had a relationship during the recruiting process. I mean, Christian Rubeck, I think, literally played for Pete Hughes, or committed to Pete Hughes probably when he was at Oklahoma. I guess he probably didn't play for him. I'd have to look at the timeline to see how that all shakes out with the COVID year. Has it confused in my head, but they were particularly active in recruiting them at any time. But if you're coming from Oklahoma, if you're an Oklahoma native, the Kansas State staff is going to know who you are. It's very interesting to see how that works out. Overall, right now you can see Kansas State is really recruiting class, and this they're all in on like plus speed athlete kind of players like Dom Johnson. And it's going to be interesting to see what that kind of team looks like. That's not something that we see a ton of around the country. So maybe they can find a little niche there. And I mean, at the very least, it makes for an exciting offense if you've got a lineup full of guys that are always trying to take the extra base and can really make things difficult on defenses. There are teams that do this. It's not like a unique thought happening there, but you think about Louisville and how exciting they can be to watch at times. If Kansas State can kind of get in that kind of mold, that could be it could be something of a competitive advantage for them in the Big 12.
It is a little bit of a zig when the rest of the Big 12 zags. You know, Oklahoma State, Texas Tech, very different offenses. You know, those are like physical big boppers in the lineup. So it also is a situation maybe where just being a little bit different than what everyone else is doing in the league can really help you. The other transfer class that stands out to me, like Kansas State, is Missouri. It feels like a similar attempt here. There aren't as many super young guys. There aren't really any situations like Dom Johnson where it's just 1 year and now he's moving, but it's a similar situation where this is really heavy on guys who came in with a lot of pedigree. Carter Rustad from San Diego, one of the best prep arms in the 2020 class that made it to college. Maynard DeSantis, I think you'll have to correct me if I'm wrong, but the highest rated player who made it to campus in 2018.
He was.
Yeah. Austin Morozas, a JUCO transfer who Charlotte.
Well, highest position player, I should say.
Right.
Kamar Rocker.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, that was Rocker's year. So highest position. It was like top 30 though. Austin Morozas from Charlotte, who came in last year with a lot of fanfare out of junior college. Those three guys right there, different levels of success. Rustad had a really good shortened 2020 season, inconsistent 2021. Inconsistent could also describe Morozas's year in Charlotte. DeSantis has never really hit at Florida State. He'll show occasional power. But then you take those three guys, you add on top of them, Austin Cheeley, a hard-throwing guy from Middle Tennessee whose numbers haven't been very good. Fox Liam, a big, strong power hitter at Coastal Carolina that hasn't produced yet. And then you got a couple of lower division guys who, you take flyers on those guys. Those are relatively local players who put up numbers at their plate. But with those first five guys, you've got really loud tools that are clear as day. And it's just a matter of if they pop at Missouri. And so it feels to me like this seems like a little too unkind, but it does feel like they're bought five lottery tickets. And, you're kind of hoping like two of them pop. They would take all five, sure. But if, DeSantis hits for a little more average or really locks in and hits 10 or 12 home runs and Carter Rustad is your Friday guy, like, okay, they'll take that, because this feels a little bit more. K-State, I think, is still betting on, hey, these guys might be productive players for us still 3 years down the road in the case of a Dom Johnson, or 2 years down the road. Missouri's betting on, we need one really good year out of these guys to hit their potential, and let's see if we can put it all together in 2022.
Mizzou is in an interesting situation here in that they have a shortstop. Like, Josh Day is back, and they're very happy with what he provided last year. And then they went out and they contains one of the better defensive shortstops coming to college. So I just don't know how their infield's going to set up next year. One of those guys is probably going to be a little bit of an odd man out or have to go play in the outfield or something. And it's going to make for an interesting fall and early spring while they sort everything out there in Como.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, we talked about this. This is, kind of what we talked about last week, where it's, schools like Missouri, where they know they're not going to, if they're realistic about it, I'm sure they are, they're not going to recruit with the best in the SEC. And so sometimes you have to take some risks. And I think this transfer class has got some risk in it. And, it's relatively reasonable risk, because if, Nader DeSantis doesn't perform any better than he did at FSU, he's going to be there 1 year and then you move on. So it's manageable risk, but it is risk because, the thing about these situations, if you bring in these large transfer classes, and we see this with JUCOs from time to time too, large JUCO classes that when they don't work, they really don't seem to work. And so there is some risk there as far as that goes. A smattering, I mentioned smaller classes, a smattering just quickly of two-man classes here throughout. And boy, these are really hard to place. So, I mean, the first one of which is Ole Miss at 13. We talked about that one last week, so we won't dive too much there. But Jack Washburn, John Gaddis, two-man class, both were ranked highly in our top 100 transfers, both address a need. So they kind of get a little bit of benefit of the doubt there. Mississippi State is not too far behind as I scroll here. 17, RJ Yeager from Mercer, Jess Davis from UAB. Mississippi State gets a little bit of a bump just because they seem to be good at this in terms of really fitting need. So they end up getting a little bit of benefit of the doubt there. Miami, the class we talked about before, led by Max Gormero Jr. They also got Jacob Burke from Southeastern Louisiana. So a few two-man classes there. You know, we talked about last week how difficult it can be, but I think in all of those cases, those are situations where it would be shocking if those six players in those three two-man classes aren't, you know, big contributors for their teams next year.
Yeah, certainly we'll be interested, especially at Miami. I feel like they really need those two guys, and Ole Miss needs them too. I feel like they don't need them as much in Starkville. Like, they're definitely going to look for Yeager and Davis to be contributors, but I feel like there's a little more around them. Whereas if you're bringing in a catcher who you expect to be your starting catcher in Maxwell Romero Jr., or you're bringing in a Team USA arm like Ole Miss is, there's a little more expectation and a little more pressure riding on those guys' shoulders in Coral Gables and Oxford.
Yeah, a couple of the classes that were near misses for me, and I don't have them like extensively written down here, but Clemson I considered, but they were a two-man class and their guys weren't highly ranked. They might be, I have to look at this, the only team that had two players in the top 100 who was not a rank, that was not a ranked class. That's because it was literally only those two players. One is Tyler Corbett from the Citadel, second baseman from the Citadel. I think he's going to be a real catalyst for Clemson. I really like him as a player. The other is Benjamin Blackwell from Dayton. He's a shortstop who had a breakout year with the bat in 2021. So Clemson's kind of hoping that breakout was real and not just, you know, a good 4 months of his career. So two-man class there that was considered. Texas is also considered, and they had a kind of a fascinating class because it is outside of Skylar Messenger from Kansas, who I think they're basically hoping is the 2022 version of what Benjamin Sims was for Michigan as a transfer from Kansas last year. Other than him, it is a class full of kind of younger guys who I think they realize that they don't need a ton of help this year. The team is very good. So I think it's a few younger guys. I think they're just kind of hoping that maybe you're more of something in 23 or 24. So that was a class I considered largely on the strength of Messenger, plus the potential of the other guys, but ended up missing the cut.
Will be interesting to look back at this year. Like I said earlier, I mean, there's a lot of experimental feeling to this. Just, it's so new. We'll see where it goes and see how the portal continues to affect teams. But it is going to be a roster building aspect going forward for everyone around the country, really, that has to deal with it, either with players going in or going out or both. So certainly going to be something we continue to revisit here on the Baseball America College podcast and over on the website, where you can read the full top 25 classes. All right, Joe, let's dive into a little bit of realignment. I guess the multiple reports suggesting that the American Athletic Conference is close to kind of finalizing its plans for replacing the three schools it lost to the Big 12. That's Cincinnati, Central Florida, and Houston. And it looks like initially they're looking to bring on Air Force and Colorado State, and then that will not be the final bit of AAC expansion. There's a lot of talk about Alabama, Birmingham, as well, but it does look like the first pass is going to be Air Force and Colorado State. And from a baseball perspective, Colorado State does nothing but add to the not insignificant collection of American Athletic Conference schools that don't play baseball. Air Force is not going to help
the American from an RPI standpoint necessarily, although I am interested to see what their kind of national schedule does for them outside of the Mountain West, if they're playing more games against schools like ECU and South Florida and Tulane, Wichita State. But you know, we had Coach Kaz on the podcast a year ago. Then Air Force went out and had a pretty good season, and it seems like things are kind of looking up at Air Force, and I don't know how immediately competitive they would be in a very difficult baseball conference, but they were on the edge of the at-large debate at times this spring. And, you know, they have in Paul Skeens, their catcher slash closer, a true star for the next few years. So, you know, it's coming at an interesting time, assuming this conference change does come to pass for Air Force.
Yeah, that one really, really fascinating. And I'm a little bit, I don't want to say surprised, because I'm not as, you know, I'm not well-sourced in this. Like for example, our friend Matt Brown, who was on the podcast a few weeks ago, is this stuff. But the American is interesting because you mentioned they have a lot of non-baseball playing members. They also, it's not unprecedented for them to have a service academy as a football member, but keep other sports in a different league. And so it's interesting that Air Force appears, at least based on these reports, to be going all in on the American, as opposed to what Navy did, which is football in the American and other sports remain in the Patriot League. Maybe the Mountain West was not amenable to that. I mean,
I do think that's probably part of it, that the Patriot League didn't have Navy football to begin with. So when Navy football joined the American, the Patriot League had nothing really to say about it. And also a little bit of, well, okay, if the Mountain West wasn't going to be okay with Air Force leaving for football, and why would they be really? Then where do you park the rest of your programs? Like, are you going to, like, say the Missouri Valley? And, you know, is that positive? Like, I don't know. And then, you know, if you're going to be in a conference with a ton of travel, I mean, Air Force is in an advantageous position to be kind of a far-flung member in a conference anyway.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah, as you were talking, I was thinking it through, and I was like, well, you know, it's
plus I mean, with Colorado State and Air Force being in the most eastern members of the Mountain West, I mean, to become the most western members of the American, probably not, they might not see that much difference in travel anyway.
I think Air Force too. Now, first of all, by the way, I mean, one of these issues we run into when you talk about mid-major conferences and conference realignment is so much of it is made with football and just to a lesser degree basketball in mind, that some of these schools end up getting hosed, where you're sending your, you know, the administration is paying through the nose to send their, you know, I don't want to pick a sport because it sounds like I'm picking on a sport, but they're non-revenue sports all getting on a plane to fly across the country to play conference games that just don't make any sense. Air Force though, you know, in our conversation with Coach Kaz, like, not as much of an issue with Air Force. Those guys are prepared to fly anywhere, and have the financial backing to do so. So not an issue with them. Although I think, frankly, Air Force should have their teams fly fighter jets to their games. They should just all fly in their full uniforms and by their uniforms, I don't mean their baseball uniforms. Oh, that'd be kind of fun if they were flying them in their baseball uniforms and they just got out and walked on the field and took in and out. I would like to propose that. But yeah, I mean, from a baseball standpoint, if you're, no disrespect to Air Force, and I agree with you on all accounts, they do seem like a program that has some momentum now. But when you talk about Colorado State not adding anything at all, Air Force, you know, not having a lot of history baseball wise. And even UAB, I like the hire of Casey Dunn. Like, I think they got the right guy to try to maximize UAB, but they're not there yet. So if you're...
I think UAB can get better under Casey Dunn. Like, he won at Samford, but I do think they're going to have... If they're going to try to compete with Tulane and South Florida and East Carolina and, you know, schools like that, they're going to have to get a bigger investment than they've shown to this point.
Agreed. So if you're the baseball playing schools of the American that are left over, most notably, you know, East Carolina and Tulane, you're kind of looking at this and you're going, woo, this ain't it. You know, now the schools that they were probably hoping for were never really the most attractive candidates. Southern Miss, you know, FAU, You could have made an argument for Rice. That one makes a little more sense. But like Southern Miss and FAU were probably never going to be on the tip of the tongue for being involved in this particular move. So those were kind of pipe dreams. But given what they've got, and with the possibility of Boise State still being among the more attractive candidates for the American, especially now since they've already made overtures to teams out west, that's not adding anything either. So not a, as far as these rumors go, the baseball playing rumors, the American can't be overly thrilled with what they've gotten so far, but I feel like they probably already knew that it was a pipe dream to be able to really enhance the conference from a baseball standpoint with what they were going to get this time around.
Well, I mean, you also heard Charlotte get talked about, and I know that Robert Woodard has only done this for 1 year really at Charlotte, but what you saw last year out of Charlotte would have been pretty attractive. Coastal Carolina was getting talked about, and I felt like that was probably not super likely. They're just, the rise of Coastal Carolina as an athletic department is fast for sure, but that would have been a little more accelerated than I would have expected it to be had they or if they still get involved in this. But I mean, if you add either one of those schools into the American, I would feel a lot better if I was, you know, at ECU or USF or Tulane or Wichita baseball. But yeah, I mean, it was never going to be run by baseball. There were some better baseball playing members that you expected to be incorporated into the discussions. But to this point right now, this is kind of, I don't want to say worst case scenario, because it probably could have been worse, but it's certainly not, like I said, the last time we talked about, I guess when the schools left the American, the days of the American contending for, you know, to rank as high in conference RPI as number three, which they have done multiple times as a conference in their short, the short time that the conference has existed. I mean, they sure looked like they were over, having lost the three schools that they lost plus UConn a year ago. But if this is the additions, I definitely think that kind of situation is over. And then what does that mean for the American's ability to get a host? What does that mean for their ability to have a top eight seed? You know, the schools that have those aspirations going to have to schedule differently in the non-conference. We'll just have to wait and see till all the dust settles on it. But I would think that right now they're going to have to try a little bit harder to find some more high profile non-conference games than some of them have played to this point. I mean, I guess I'm thinking specifically of ECU, which just hasn't, you know, lives on, like, gets really good RPIs in part because of the conference and in part because they play an incredibly taxing midweek schedule, but doesn't always, you know, they aren't a school that necessarily is playing mammoth weekend series every year. They certainly have done so. I mean, they've played Virginia. I think they did NC State as a weekend a few years ago. I mean, if they can, they just need to go back to doing something like that. And if they're going to have to make up RPI ground somewhere.
Yeah. And, you know, Cliff Godwin has been enough places where I think they'll be able to pivot to do that pretty easily. But the tricky thing with them that we've talked about before is that it probably means East Carolina is going to have to play a few more road games, and not just from an RPI standpoint, all that helps, but, you know, getting teams to Greenville is probably not the easiest thing in the world. I think East Carolina is actually a pretty attractive opponent because you don't lose much playing East Carolina. They're always going to be good. They're always going to push you. Yeah. You might get beat, but it's not going to hurt your metrics really. But it is a difficult place to get to. And so, you know, that adds a little layer of complication to it. You know, maybe it means they explore some tournament situations, or they get really aggressive with what they're doing with the LeClaire Classic. As it is right now, the LeClaire Classic, the tournament they play at East Carolina every year, is like one out of every three or four years is a banger. A couple of years ago, they had Ole Miss there. They had Indiana there. That was a really good one. In other years, it's not so much. So maybe they just end up needing to get really aggressive with that every year. And maybe that's part of the solution, but you're right. I mean, they're going to have to probably do something here.
Well, so that is definitely one thing we're tracking. There was a bit of realignment news that was actually announced this week, and that is Belmont is the latest school that's going to leave the Ohio Valley Conference. They will join the Missouri Valley Conference. And from a baseball standpoint, I mean, Belmont has potential, but I mean, that's, it's not as high profile as some of the other moves that we've seen roaming around. The more significant thing here, Joe, I think, is that the Ohio Valley Conference is reeling after losing several members already. And I mean, they're just, it's not the conference it was a year ago. They, you were running through all the changes that they've had just in the last year, and it's rather significant.
Yeah, it's a conference that's bleeding right now, frankly. And, you know, you look at the teams that have left, it's a lot of their members that have upward mobility. It's Jacksonville State, who threw a bunch of money at athletics, including a new baseball facility. You know, it's Eastern Kentucky that has, you know, they were probably always going to leave because, frankly, from what I understand, Eastern Kentucky has like FBS football aspirations. So they were always going to have to move. But still, Belmont is one of the schools in the OVC. It's a pretty rural conference, but they're in Nashville. So they've always had a little bit of upward mobility just from the standpoint of, hey, you're in a big city in a conference full of schools that are in pretty rural areas. So they've lost a lot of their firepower, not just from a baseball standpoint, but just in general. And now what you kind of have, it reminds me of the debate we have more so in football than in baseball, but there's this debate about if you're a mid-major school that's been successful, do you want a coach who's going to come in and do a really, really good job for 2 years and then bounce to the next job? Because theoretically, his 2 years of success has made the program that much more attractive moving forward. Or do you want to try to find your forever coach, the coach that just loves being where they are and they end up being there for 15, 20 years and really build something? And there's an argument, I think, to be made on both sides. I think the OVC is in that kind of place now where the bad news is you've lost, like I said, these programs with upward mobility, these schools with upward mobility athletically, or so it seems from the outside. The flip side is there are a lot of, I mean, I feel like they're in a similar place to the Summit League now, where the Summit League is kind of in this precarious position where they're kind of at such a low number that they have to kind of keep making sure they can stay eligible for postseason play in baseball specifically. And I'm sure it's happening in other sports, but on the flip side, they do have a lot of members that really aren't necessarily going anywhere. You know, although Western Illinois has been rumored to be one of the teams going into the OVC. So it's funny how that works, but so what the OVC is left with is maybe a little bit of maybe the most stable members they have, but I don't really know what we're looking at in terms of programs that you would feel really, really good about having growth potential in baseball specifically, but just more generally.
One other thing that I saw this week was that Southern Indiana announced that they're going to explore a move from Division II to Division I. They weren't committing to it, but they are actively exploring that idea, and they acknowledged as much. That would be a significant baseball move. The Screaming Eagles, yes, they are the Screaming Eagles, won the Division 14, and you know, the kind of, I mean, they, I don't know exactly which conferences would be looking at them, but I bet the Ohio Valley is one of them. And I think they could go in and compete in the Ohio Valley or the Summit League or wherever it is they end up in all likelihood if they do make the move on the diamond, because you know, they have been it's not just those two national titles. They've just been a consistently really good program. And, you know, we've seen a lot of Division II teams move up and continue to be successful recently. You know, looking at Grand Canyon and Cal Baptist, especially, but you know, even Merrimack had some impressive moments in its early tenure as a Division I program. So Southern Indiana would be a potential needle mover on the diamond if they do make a move.
Yeah, just to give listeners kind of an idea here, this did not necessarily make for great radio, but I want to give you an idea of the totality here. Teddy mentioned 12 programs who for the 2022 baseball season. So these are team schools that are in their new conferences right now for fall sports and then will be in the spring of 2022. Here are the 12 that are in new places. New to the A-Sun, Central Arkansas, Eastern Kentucky, Jacksonville State, Jacksonville State, Eastern Kentucky from the OVC, Central Arkansas from the Southland. In the Big South, North Carolina A&T comes over from the MEAC. The Summit League, Northern Colorado joins as just a baseball member from the WAC, kind of a weird little deal there. And then St. Thomas of Minnesota comes up from Division III. I have a story on the site from last year about St. Thomas kind of getting ready for that move. So that's there if you want to check that out. Moving to the SWAC, Bethune-Cookman, Florida A&M, both from the MEAC. And in the WAC, Abilene Christian, Lamar, Sam Houston, and Stephen F. Austin all come out of the Southland. So that's all the movement for the 2022 season. There's a few more that are on deck for 2023, including Belmont, Austin Peay moving to the A-Sun, Texas A&M Commerce coming up from Division II to the Southland. And then the big stuff, the Big 12 moves, the move to the SEC comes in years after that. But this is the most movement we've had in a long, long time. And it, to your point, it feels like we're just kind of right now, it just feels like we're maybe at something like the midpoint of all this settling.
A lot happening for sure. A lot we're going to have to, remind ourselves of when conference previews come out. So just something to keep an eye on as all of this continues to shake out. We'll certainly continue talking about it and how all of it affects baseball here on the Baseball America College podcast. Joe, before we get out of here today, we are recording this on the 29th. On Wednesday, which apparently is National Coffee Day. And so, we don't have a guest to talk about sandwiches. So let's talk coffee. And if you have any sort of standing idea of what your coffee order is.
I don't actually. I'm surprised you forgot this conversation from Omaha, or maybe you're just teeing me up for it. I actually do not
Let's drink, go with that.
I actually do not drink coffee. I have never purchased and drank my own cup of coffee. Now, I actually said that I actually said that to Chris Burke in Omaha, and he was like, "What do you mean? Do you just drink other people's cups?" I was like, "No." Like, what I mean is that I've had people be like, "Hey, try this," and I'll have a few sips of like either a cup of coffee they've given me or of their coffee, like with my wife, for example. But I've never gone and got a cup of coffee for myself. I think a couple things are happening here. One is I have been for a long time. I drink too much diet soda. That is my caffeine of choice is diet soda. I drink too much of it. I know that the artificial sweeteners are not good for me. But here we are. We all have our vices in life. The second thing is my mom was an aggressive coffee drinker. I'll never forget going to a Mexican restaurant around the corner from our house growing up. And my mom would order like a plate of enchiladas and a cup of coffee. She drank coffee with everything. She drank coffee all day and didn't switch to decaf, by the way. She was just someone who was so desensitized to it that she could still get to sleep. But she drank coffee morning, noon, and night. And I think it's just one of those things where like, I was just around it so much as a kid. And she drank, by the way, the crappy stuff. Like she drank it out of the metal tin you'd buy at the grocery store for, $5 for the whole tin, and then she'd stock up and put it in the freezer and it was just not the good stuff. But I think I was just around it so much and smelled it so much as a kid. And I had a couple sips as a kid. And of course, as a kid, coffee's not something that tastes good. And so I was just like, I don't want this. And I've just never really circled back on it. I do, however, and I actually had this conversation with my wife. I do predict I will start drinking coffee in the next 5 to 7 years. I can feel it coming on. Like I'm starting to like really enjoy, like my wife loves coffee and like is all about
step of your suburban dad life.
That basically, yeah.
Of which are actually true.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. I'm basically a dad except for having a kid at this point, but I should probably actually just go get my wife on this podcast, tell you about her coffee habits. Cause that's more interesting, but, but yeah, she's really into it. I suspect I will get there at some point. I am just not there right now.
I guess somewhere in the middle. Like, I had a similar experience with coffee growing up in that my father drinks it all the time, or drank it all the time, and no time was too late for it, and all the rest of it. But I became more of a tea drinker ultimately. And I am the weird one in my family for that. So National Coffee Day here on the Baseball America College podcast.
Yeah. My wife also a big tea person. We were in Boulder. This is a little recommendation incoming for people. We were in Boulder a few weeks ago. My sister got married in Colorado, and we hung around and went to Boulder for a few days. And their sister cities with Boulder is sister cities with Dushanbe, Tajikistan. And I guess as part of that arrangement, and most times sister city relationships are mostly ceremonial, but in this case, people from Tajikistan, I guess, came to Boulder, and they did like this kind of cultural exchange where they built in Tajikistan a traditional Tajik tea house, and then so built it and then disassembled it and shipped it to Boulder and built it back up in Boulder. And so they have this traditional Tajik tea house there that serves a full menu, full food menu, but they do like a tea service as well, traditional tea service. And it is gorgeous in there. And the food was really good. I can't remember what I had. I had like some sort of fish dish, but it was in like a brothy, almost like a soup. It was like sitting in a soup with some noodles kind of. But it was very, very good. I forget what my wife had, but she tried several different teas while we were there and really, really enjoyed them. And the tea list is like hundreds of teas long. But if you're in Boulder, the Dushanbe Tea House, food is very good. The tea is very good from what I understand, but it's just kind of an experience. It's all hand painted inside and it's very ornately decorated. Kind of just a unique experience that I don't feel like you can get anywhere else. So because we didn't have a sandwich today, that's what we're doing. We're talking about coffee, tea, and the Dushanbe Tea House in Boulder.
I mean, that does sound like a unique experience that you're not going to find too many other places. So the next time I'm at University of Colorado, or they
see right.
Next time I'm at CU for a baseball game. Oh, wait.
Yeah. Beautiful campus. They should do baseball. The views would be great. It's a beautiful campus.
All righty. So that's what we got for you today on the Baseball America College podcast. Thank you all for tuning in again this week. And we will be back next week with another edition, probably with the guests this time. We've gone guestless the last couple of weeks, but we'll get back to the guests next week here as we continue through the offseason with our weekly shows here. Make sure to follow along, subscribe, rate, review, all the rest of that on your favorite podcasting platforms, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts, you can do that. Follow us on Twitter. I'm at Ted Cahill. Joe is at Joe Healy, BA. And all of the articles we talked about can, of course, be found at baseballamerica.com. Thank you to Rapsodo for presenting this edition of the Baseball America College podcast and every episode. For Joe, I'm Teddy. We'll talk to you next time.